Previously on Beta.
What's all this fuss I keep hearing about violins and television?
Well, the universe is everything, and if it's expanding, someday it will break apart and that will be the end of everything.
What is that your business?
You hit on the wrong girl the wrong day, Kevin.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, sitcom maestro Michael Schur. You may know him as the creator of The Office, Parks and Recreation, and The Good Place. Now it's time to know Michael as the author of the very funny philosophy book, How to Be Perfect.
The joke that we had was that there was a red phone in the writer's room at The Good Place that we could pick up, like, you know, Reagan calling the Kremlin and say, there's a philosophical emergency, we need your help.
Also, Gwen Kirby introduces us to some of the funniest and angriest women you'll ever meet in her debut short story collection. It's been billed as Margaret Atwood meets Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
You know, one of the things I always found so weird about witch trials was, like, if you were a witch, how were a bunch of, like, lame villagers in the 1500s going to kill you? You would just use your magic.
But first, if you're looking for a comedian who personifies anger, you need look no further than Lewis Black. Pixar chose him to literally voice the part of anger in the Academy Award-winning film Inside Out. I would argue that that is the part Lewis was born to play, but I wouldn't dare argue with Lewis. He'd wipe the floor with me.
You want a piece of this, Pops? Come and get it!
Lewis has been ranting and raving about the absurdities of contemporary life since the 90s. He's also written 3 best-selling books and more than 40 plays. His latest special is called Thanks for Risking Your Life. It was filmed on March 13th, 2020, the day that the U.S. government declared a state of emergency due to the coronavirus epidemic. Since the crowd was already at the venue, Lewis and his crew went ahead and filmed what may be the last comedy special before the U.S. locked down.
And so finally the box answered. Took a while, but it said, well, a McNugget is a McNugget. And a tender is a tender. Well, armed with that information, I threw caution to the wind. I'm kind of a foodie, so I said, hey, bring on the tenders. I drove up to the window. The employee came to the window. I said, don't go in yet, please. Before you go, tell me, do you know the difference between a McNugget and a tender? Without any hesitation, the employee said, well, the tender tastes a bit more like chicken. That's what's wrong with America.
We do a live stream called The Rant Is Due, and so we have 2 cameras we run every night. So we had those, and we got a couple more, and figured we'd shoot it just for posterity. Here's a record of in my final performances. I didn't know if any other comic would have a record of theirs, but at least we had put it away in a time capsule. And so then when I finished, I realized in part myself, I realized that what I had done on stage was really the rough draft, not the rough draft, but the written draft of what would become my special.
Many of you, I'm sure, don't listen to our leader. And that's a big mistake. I know that when he comes on, some of you go, and you're missing something important, an important lesson, one that he has taught me, and it has changed my life. And one of the reasons that I'm visiting your village is to share that with you. That's right. And what is that important message? And what is it that changed my life? And what is it that makes me so happy now? Is because my leader has taught me that if I think it, it's true.
And I came off stage and Jeff Stilson, who was opening for me, said, that's the special. Everything else I had done up to that point was done on the larger scale. And this one had an intimacy to it that I'd not seen in other specials.
Mm-hmm. You deliver some very funny, very timely, and very smart jokes in Thanks for Risking Your Life. And one of my favorites is where you talk about just how far apart the two major political parties are now. How far apart are they?
The joke became and evolved into the fact that it used to be, you know, the political parties had an agenda, and, you know, they were fighting for some sort of, you know, this is what I believe, this is what I believe. And it was about, you know, should we lower taxes? Should we raise taxes? Should we do this for people? Should we do that for people? Should we have infrastructure? Should we not have infrastructure? What is the limits of the federal government? What is the state government? All of that stuff. And now that's gone completely out the window, and we've done what I said, and I was doing it as a joke, and it wasn't about the parties, it was just about us, that we were and now reached the point that we were fighting over realities.
We've done something with these two political parties that really is unbelievable. No other country has done it. No other country. We used to have parties that argue ideas. Ha ha, nothing more. Now we have two separate political parties that actually exist in two totally different realities. And if you didn't laugh at that, you.
The more I travel around the country, I was in Florida, where you go to, we're in New York where I live, and I imagine Madison and then parts of Wisconsin. It's like you go from one reality to another. You know, I left New York and the Oh My God virus, as I call it, was hitting there. And people were masking up again, and never had stopped masking. They were masking on the streets in New York City. They were not fooling around. Then I got to Florida. It was like, woohoo, it's over. You know, it was done there. And there is a real fight in this country. It's those two realities.
Mm-hmm. You have this great routine about an over-the-counter supplement called Prevagen. How has Prevagen changed your life?
I wish it had. I've never bought it.
Okay, how has it not changed your life?
I never bought the stuff.
It's a remarkable memory-enhancing drug. It's spectacular. It's a miracle. If I'd taken my Prevagen, I would have remembered to take my Prevagen. It's so powerful, you don't even need a prescription. It's as powerful in many ways, and as much of a miracle as our other drugs that are miracles, vitamin C and aspirin. Every drugstore in America sells it. It's still on the shelves, unlike toilet paper.
But my favorite thing about Prevagen is it came from it, which has an ingredient originally found in jellyfish, which is such a great, now they've made them take that out. That line is gone. After they dropped that, they were bringing out these spokespeople, and it would say underneath, spokesperson, you know, I'm not a moron. You know, I mean, it's like, I don't need Prevagen to remind me what spokesperson means. You paid somebody to basically give you a testimonial, you jackasses. So you've gone from shilling on one level to shilling on another level. And these people are, of course, what do you think? You know, I would like anything for $100,000. It's great. Yeah. You know, just to do one commercial, that's always good.
Mm-hmm, probably. Since we're here in America's Dairyland, I have to ask you about cow cuddling. What's your take on cow cuddling?
It's unbelievable to me that people would... I've never driven by a dairy farm or looked at the fields as my tour bus that I'm on is rolled by a field filled with cows and thought, God, I got to get out there and hug one of those beasts.
Cuddling a warm 1,000-pound cow can impart a sense of calm. The farm's website says because the animals, and this is in quotes, sense if you are happy, sad, feel lost, a cow feels, wow, this person feels lost. A cow? Anxious or are excited. If you're hugging a cow and you feel excited, you need to see a doctor bad.
You've been ranting for almost 25 years now. Is it fair to say that as our world has become more messed up, your anger that you express on stage is less exaggerated and more genuine?
Wow, it's still got to be, yeah, I mean, it's where it comes from has always been genuine. What you got to do is always, it just can't be angry. You got to play it. There's a fine line, because if you cross that line, which I used to do before I figured it out, it kind of pushes the audience away. What's funny is I was trying to find other ways to be. I did a whole, I can't even remember the name of the concert that I did, you know, the special that I did, where I tried to calm down everything and find another way to express anger without yelling at all of the stuff. And the major criticism of that special was that, oh, he got tired. He's not yelling anymore. Because I thought I was saying things in a way that were more vicious than when I was yelling.
Has talking about this Kafkaesque absurdity that we find ourselves immersed in, has that taken any kind of a psychic toll on you?
Yeah, what it has done is made, it's not a psychic toll, but what it has done is, How do you satirize something that's already satiric? That's the hard part. My job, this is where it's broken me. My job is to be more insane than what I see. And ball game is over. I didn't think I could get to this point. I never thought I'd get to the point where that I couldn't come up with. And then every so often, I had a couple of times during the past 4 months where I woke up and went, that's it. Eureka, I think I've got it. I've just got to write this down and then I fall back asleep. But that's the only, I've had two or three moments where I get it. It's like the thing about, you know, it's retooling the joke each year.
How would you, Lewis Black, fix what's wrong with America if you were given the chance?
Home room. I would send every American every morning before they went to work, in terms of anybody over the age of 18, that's it. Everybody has to, in alphabetical order, get together. So you have 30 people and they have to get together in a room for 5 minutes and they have to say the Pledge of Allegiance. And they have to look at each other and they have to spend that 5 to 10 minutes together. And then there's morning announcements. The president should say something. And then whoever wants to speak from the majority party, and whoever wants to speak for the minority party, and that's it. They have to sit there and listen to that. And then they have lunch suggestions. And then you start your work day. But that's really where things went awry, I think, is that you're not putting people in a room together. And especially now, this is the perfect storm of, you know, that you're not in the public square and you're not seeing people that these people who 4 years ago wouldn't yell at each other about this stuff because they dealt with each other every day and they would talk about a football game. And so if you do that, then all of a sudden yelling at that person about something else becomes, it's tougher if you've bonded. And we've stopped bonding on just the dopey levels.
Yeah, very well said. Lewis Black, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot. That was great.
Comedian Lewis Black is the king of the rant. His latest comedy special is Thanks for Risking Your Life. Find out more at wpr.org/beta.
Because of the internet, because of Twitter and Facebook, and everybody has a camera phone, we are constantly being bombarded with moral questions and ethical questions in a way we never have been before.
Coming up, television writer and producer Michael Schur joins us to tell us how to be perfect. Assuming, of course, that we're not already. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
I was a good person for 6 months. That's like 5 years. And it felt okay, but not as good as I thought it would. And what did I get for it?
Ah, see, now you're talking about moral dessert.
Exactly. Wait, I am what?
Moral dessert is the concept that if you act with virtue, you deserve a reward.
Right. If I'm not gonna get rewarded somehow with like a tiara or one of those diagonal word belts.
Sash.
Sure.
Sash.
Then why should I do good things?
That's a clip from the acclaimed fantasy comedy series, The Good Place. Michael Schur is the show's creator. He's also the co-creator of Parks and Recreation and Brooklyn Nine-Nine. If you noticed that there were a lot of philosophical references on The Good Place, congratulations, you're forking right. And it was Michael who put them there. He's been interested in ethics for his entire life. And now he's channeled that interest into an entertaining, enlightening, and inspiring book called How to Be Perfect, The Correct Answer to Every Moral Question. He explains heady concepts like utilitarianism and my personal favorite, existentialism, with his suitably Schur-esque sense of humor. Michael joined us from New York for a perfect conversation where he described his own super lame behavior, which inspired The Good Place and his book.
I caught myself doing something odd at a Starbucks near my house where I would go in and order a medium coffee. It was $1.73. I would pay in cash and then I would throw the 27 cents into the tip jar, as many people do. But one day I realized that I didn't just do that. I waited until the barista had turned around to see me do it, meaning that I craved some kind of moral credit or something for such a pathetic tip. And I started interrogating myself and wondering why I did that. What was I after? What did I want out of that transaction? Why would I, you know, that a tip is ostensibly a thank you to the person who has provided you a service, not a thing that you get credit for, right? So
exactly.
So I just started sort of wondering and talking to people and reading stuff about what it was that I was after. And I sort of stumbled on this idea that I write about in the book called moral desert, which is the feeling that we want credit when we're good people, which is a really fascinating topic that I think is very universal.
Mm-hmm. It reminds me of that Seinfeld episode in which George takes the money he put in the tip jar out of the tip jar.
You got no credit.
Exactly. It's like I'm throwing a buck away. I mean, if they don't notice it, what's the point?
So you don't make a habit of giving to the blind?
Not bills.
Yes, that I had never seen that episode. And then when I wrote about this, someone said like, oh, there was a Seinfeld story about this. I went back and watched it. And it was weirdly encouraging to me because I thought like, well, the moments in writing the show, The Good Place, or this book that I have felt the happiest about were the ones that seemed to be the most universal, that where I had stumbled onto something or tapped into something that a lot of different people feel. And so the fact that there was an episode of TV about this 20 years ago made me feel like, oh, okay, I'm not alone here. This is a thing that many people have experienced, which I think is really ultimately the point of the book, is to try to pinpoint these little weird things that we all do and asking the question of why we do them.
Mm-hmm. And you do it so very well and with a great deal of humor, which is not surprising coming from you. How much did you know about moral philosophy when you came up with the idea for The Good Place?
I had what I would call a Wikipedia level understanding of it. Like I had taken a couple classes in college and didn't remember much from them. And I had, at various times in my life, I had done something and thought like, why the hell am I doing that? And then poking around and reading some stuff. It was definitely the situation that I needed to do a lot of reading and a lot of studying leading up to writing the show before I felt like I could really write it properly.
Now, you got a long way to go to pull this off. It will take hours and hours of studying ethics and moral philosophy. We're gonna have assignments and quizzes and papers. It's gonna be so much fun.
Remind me what I'm getting out of this again.
You get to avoid eternal damnation.
Oh yeah, right. Hey, I got you a present.
What?
Senegal.
That's not a present. That's just common decency.
Yeah, but I forkin' nailed it.
So the show accelerated what was a sort of latent or quiet interest that I had had at various points in my life.
Sounds like you needed a cheaty. So what did you do? You talked a bit about it, but can you tell us a bit more about like which works you read and how they helped you?
Yes, absolutely. I started with a book called Justice by Michael Sandel. That was a very popular class in college that I never took. I wish I had. And he wrote a book that it sort of is an overview of the main theories of justice or ethics from the Western philosophical world over the last, you know, couple thousand years. There are a bunch of other books that served as sort of entry points or overviews. I talked to this started on the show later, but I had a lot of conversations with a couple professors One of whom is named Todd May, who became a sort of official philosophy advisor on the show. The joke that we had was that there was a red phone in the writer's room at the Good Place that we could pick up, like, you know, Reagan calling the Kremlin and say, there's a philosophical emergency. We need your help. He also helped me with the book. He was a sort of the philosophical advisor for the book as well. And then a woman named Pamela Hieronymy, who taught at UCLA, was a huge help and talked to the writers a bunch and helped me and read the first four chapters of the book. And so it was a combo platter of reading a bunch of stuff, including the original texts of Aristotle and Mill and Bentham and a bunch of people like that. And then also talking to these people who do this professionally and could really sort of break them down for me.
Mm-hmm. I like that idea, combo platter. So it was kind of all you can read.
That's
combo
right.
Combo platter. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The German philosopher Immanuel Kant is a big influence on Chidi and The Good Place. Can you tell us about that?
Well, Chidi, we wanted the character of Chidi to be the most kind of concerned, obviously, with ethical behavior. He was a professor of moral philosophy in his life on Earth, and he suffers from something that a lot of ethicists suffer from, which is a sort of paralysis.
It would be easier to sort out the issue of dry erase versus paper if I could write down the pros and cons for each. But, of course, I would have to use one of them to write down the pros and cons for them, which is problematic.
Wow!
Ethics team, how's it going?
Terribly.
Cool. Well, you guys are kind of my last hope, so that's not great. Hey, do you mind if I borrow Professor Stomachache here for a second?
Please, take him for an hour. Take all the time you want.
So we wanted Chidi to be Kantian because his main sort of Achilles heel in his life on Earth, all of the characters, all of the human characters on the show had a sort of Achilles heel, and his was that he was so paralyzed by his concern with whether what he was doing with that was ethical that he essentially drove everyone crazy. He just made everyone around him miserable because he could, you know, someone would say, like, let's go get something to eat, and then he would have to look at the menu and weigh the ethical degrees to which, you know, whether you should order salmon or tuna fish or whatever. So that is a Kantian kind of person, I think, is the person who believes that there's a right answer to every question and is in constant search for that right answer and then makes everyone around him miserable.
Mm, very well said. Fans of The Good Place will be well aware of the trolley problem. Why is this philosophy's most famous thought experiment?
Well, you know, it was invented in 1967 by a woman named Philippa Foot, who is a British philosopher, and it is still, you know, philosophy 101 classes often start with the trolley problem today.
You are driving a trolley when the brakes fail, and on the track ahead of you are five workmen that you will run over. Now, you can steer to another track, but on that track is one person you would kill instead of the five. What do you do?
I think the reason that it's so popular is because in both situations, something bad happens. And I think there is something about modern life that where that touches a nerve, right? Because we are often in situations where the reason they're tough to figure out is because in both versions of what you do, something bad will result. And so I don't know if this was intentional on Philippa Foot's part or any of the people who have written about it since, but that to me is what it really taps into is that, you know, look, if the choice is, do you run over five people or do you pull a lever to stop the train? Well, there's no ethical dilemma there, right? Of course, you stop the trolley. But yeah, because in both scenarios, there's a result that makes it a little bit like you're sick to your stomach with what happened. That is much more reflective of the sorts of ethical dilemmas that we find ourselves in all the time. And my guess is that's why we're still talking about it.
Michael, you've been kind of quiet. What do you think about all this?
Well, obviously the dilemma is clear. How do you kill all six people? So I would dangle a sharp blade out the window to slice the neck of the guy on the other track as we smoosh our five main guys. Oh, I did the thing again, didn't I?
Yep. 10 more, buddy.
People good. People good. Why is that so hard?
You address these heavy concepts with a lot of humor. How are you able to do that, or does that just kind of come naturally to you?
Well, that is my professional job, you know?
Yes,
So I've been doing it since 98 is when I started at Saturday Night Live, and I you know, it's the thing that I've been doing my whole life. So I find that humor is the most effective delivery mechanism for any kind of information or moral lesson or anything. Like, you know, on Parks and Recreation, we were talking about government, specifically local government, which is a pretty dry subject. But our bet, Greg Daniels and I created the show together, and our bet was that just like with The Office, set in a very mundane, you know, fluorescent light cubicle little universe, that if you are funny enough that you can get your message across and people will be, if people are entertained, they'll listen to what you have to say. So it's both just sort of what my job is. And also I truly believe it's the best way to convey information.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I think you're exactly right. Especially with such a like heady subject as philosophy, it really, really works well. And you did a magnificent job of that and made the book that much more entertaining and relevant to us, I think. Of course, we can't really talk about philosophy without discussing the hot new philosophical term everyone is talking about, Michael Schur's moral exhaustion. What is moral exhaustion? And how did you, Michael Schur, come up with this idea?
First of all, thank you for phrasing the question that way. In the book, I write about moral this term I'm trying to coin called moral exhaustion, and I capitalize it everywhere in the book because, as I say in a footnote, this might be my only chance to have like a cool term that enters the academic culture, and I'm really pushing for it to catch on so that in the future, thousands of years from now, there will be an alien classroom and aliens will say, who invented moral exhaustion? Oh, it was that genius Michael Schur. So what I'm referring to is a couple things that are encompassed in that term. One of them is the fact that because of the way the world works now, because of the internet, because of Twitter and Facebook and everybody has a camera phone, we are constantly being bombarded with moral questions and ethical questions in a way we never have been before. Every time a man enters a smoothie store somewhere and goes on some kind of weird racist rant and throws a smoothie at an employee, everyone across the globe instantly sees it and knows it and is sort of being asked to weigh in a moral way, right? You're being asked to judge that person's ethical behavior. That didn't used to be the case. And because we see 50 of these things a day, it can be really exhausting to feel like every single moment of your life is being phrased or sort of proffered in like an ethical or moral question. And then there's the flip side of that, which is that because we know all this information about people who are famous and not famous, we are constantly being asked to make judgments about our own lives in terms of, well, this director of movies was just revealed to be a weird creep. Do you still support his movies? Do you still watch his movies? Do you still pay for his movies? This actor or this singer or this athlete is problematic in a different way. Are you still going to root for that team? Are you going to look at that person's paintings? Like, it becomes exhausting to constantly check in and weigh in and have to decide whether or not you still support them or you still will watch their movies or listen to their music.
Hey, babe. Great news. I got us tickets to the Coyotes game.
Awesome.
But, ooh, yikes. Turns out two of the players have DUIs. Guess we can't cheer for that team.
Eleanor.
You know what? Instead, let's just stay in, watch a Roman Polanski movie, listen to R. Kelly, and eat Chick-fil-A. Does that sound good? There's bad stuff everywhere, man. It's impossible to avoid.
Yeah, but shouldn't we just try? Shouldn't we just try to do the right thing whenever we can?
Why? It's so much harder to live like that, and it's not like someone's keeping score.
That sense of exhaustion of never getting a break from the questions of whether what you're doing in something as small and personal as what music you listen to or what movies you see, you're constantly now being asked to weigh in with yourself at least about whether or not it's okay that you're still doing that. So that's what I'm trying to encapsulate with the hot new philosophy term, moral exhaustion.
Yeah, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I understand that Woody Allen was a big influence on you, and like sort of influenced you to pursue comedy, and then now you have to reckon with, you know, the misbehavior of him, but you can still appreciate his films, right?
Yes, that's the example I give in the book. Is Woody Allen was incredibly important to me. Like, my sense of humor, it's not unfair to say that my sense of humor was formed by watching Sleeper and Annie Hall and Take the Money and Run and all of those great comedies from the 70s. And then, you know, a bunch of other stuff happens where you learn about his relationship with Sun Yi Previn, and you learn about the allegations made against him involving abuse of a minor. And then when that happens, you go back and you think about some of those movies. You think about the movie Manhattan, in which He is a 43-year-old guy who's having an intimate relationship with a 16-year-old high school student. And in real life, Mariel Hemingway, who played that role, was 16 years old. And when she kissed him in that movie, it was the first time she had ever kissed another human being. And that power dynamic is pretty plainly not okay. If you did that now, if you were a 43-year-old director and you wrote a story about having a relationship with a 16-year-old and you cast a 16-year-old and you made out with that 16-year-old in Central Park, I think people would have a very different reaction to it than they had in 1984 or whatever it was when, or 1980, I can't remember now, when Woody Allen made Manhattan. So I have been forced in my life to try to reckon with the fact that the guy who was more than maybe anybody else, it's really Woody Allen and Monty Python were the two biggest people for me. And now I have to reckon with the fact that that guy is very suspect and problematic, and it's hard. It's not like there's no right answer here. There's no there's no solution to this problem. It's, you know, what I say in the book is you kind of just have to keep both of those things in your head at the same time. This person is very important to me and was formative in the way that I, you know, learned about the world and grew up and formed a personality. And also this person is problematic and has done some things that I think are unforgivable. And that is not a great place to live. It takes all the fun out of watching that person's movies. Like, you can't just shut your half of your brain off like a dolphin, you know, and only focus on half of that equation. I think you kind of just have to wrestle with it all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very well said. One of my favorite things about philosophy is the thought experiment. So I thought we would finish off with the thought experiment, if you're
great.
Okay.
Yes, absolutely.
With that. Okay,
thought experiments are my favorite part too, so hit me.
Yeah, okay, here we go. If you had created The Good Place after you wrote your book, How to Be Perfect, in what ways, if any, would The Good Place be a different show?
Wow. I think it wouldn't be as good, honestly, because the joy of making television is that it's collaborative. There has never yet been a comedy writer who can do it all him or herself. It doesn't exist. And the real joy of it is you have an idea and you work on your idea and then you invite into the room a bunch of really smart and funny people who think in ways that you don't, who pitch jokes in a way that you can't. And then you hire actors who translate those jokes and lines of dialogue into actual moments of human interconnectedness. And you have directors and you have lighting operators and camera operators and props people and costumes people and location managers and all of these people who contribute in some way to making the thing that you, your idea, better.
I want to broaden my horizons and try new things, and I will. But even though I might have gotten lost in the weeds, I loved writing this book, and I want to try again. So, will you be my advisor?
Chidi, all I want is for you to be happy. So if spending eternity getting blunt feedback on your circular, rambling ideas will make you happy, then of course I will be your advisor. Let's throw that monstrosity in the trash and start over.
Aren't there maybe some parts worth salvaging?
Honestly, man, I don't even know. I mean, that thing is unreadable. I literally learned what headaches were because that thing gave me a headache.
And I believe that I have a much greater understanding of the world of ethics because I worked first on a collaborative project where it was a discussion, a conversation, a daily conversation about not just humor and not just plot, but really like wrestling with those topics. I think that if I had written the book first and it was like, this is my pure solo version and understanding of this material, and then had gone into the show, I think it's possible that I would have been less open to that collaboration because I would feel like, well, I know all this stuff. I wrote a book about this stuff. Nobody can teach me anything about this, right? So I think that the way it happened is the most effective and organic way for it to happen, which is it's a collaboration first, and then out of that comes my personal understanding of the results of that collaboration.
What a great answer. Thank you. That thought experiment, your answer was much better than the actual thought experiment. Thank you. No, seriously, it was. I was trying to think, was that good enough thought experiment? My boss, Adam Friedrich, said, yeah, that's good. Michael Schur, thank you very much for joining us today. Congratulations on How to Be Perfect. It's funny, informative, inspiring, and philosophical, just like you. And congratulations on Moral Exhaustion. It's going to go viral by the end of the day if it hasn't already. Seriously, it's such a timely idea. You've come
great.
Up with the right,
use that,
the perfect
use that
idea
hashtag.
The perfect
everybody yeah. Hashtag moral exhaustion and we'll
yes,
see if
indeed.
We can get it trending.
That's what we're going to do when we tweet about this interview. Thank you very much, Michael.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Michael Schur is the author of How to Be Perfect, the correct answer to every moral question. He's also the creator of The Good Place. You can find out more about Michael and moral exhaustion at wpr.org/beta.
How amazing, how cool to take a risk and have the chance to bring their voices to readers who might then, you know, if I'm lucky, look them up online and learn a little bit something about how radical women really have always been.
Coming up, Gwen Kirby talks about her short story collection, which focuses on fierce, funny, and powerful women. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Midwestern girl goes to New York City, and she reminds the protagonist, of course, she is not the protagonist, of everything he has left behind. He covets her innocence and also despises it. When she gives up and returns home, he is sad, but not surprised. A flick of your wrist. Midwestern girl stands alone at a house party. The protagonist smiles at her as if to say, cheer up, and I notice subtle things. And this reminds the reader that the protagonist is secretly sensitive, no matter what terrible things he has done or will do. He and Midwestern girl never speak, and the story leaves her to sip her beer in a corner. In the living room, the protagonist punches his best friend. Will he turn out to be like his father? He ends the night hanging out with two strangers. They walk to the East River and throw rocks into the fathomless deep.
That's Gwen Kirby reading the story, Midwestern Girl is Tired of Appearing in Your Short Stories. It's from her debut short story collection, Blank Cassandra Saw. I'll let you fill in the blank. A hint, it follows Bull a lot of the time. The book is my fellow Canadian Margaret Atwood meets Buffy the Vampire Slayer. It features very funny stories about women who cannot take it anymore, and rightfully so. These women cover a wide swath of history, from ancient Greece to today. One of my favorite things about the book is Gwen's willingness to take creative risks and push the envelope so far that all that's left are itsy-bitsy tattered remnants of the envelope. Take, for instance, her piece that we just heard, Midwestern Girl is Tired of Appearing in Your Short Stories.
A few things inspired me to write that story. At the time, I was reading the slush pile for the Cincinnati Review, which is basically the term for the huge pile of submissions that any literary magazine gets at a given time. And so I was reading hundreds and hundreds of stories back to back to back, and I was noticing a lot of stories in which women characters would show up. They wouldn't really be named. They would say something helpful to the male protagonist, and then they would kind of saunter off stage. And sort of while I was doing that, I went to a reading, and this man was reading a short story, and there was a character in it that he just called Midwestern Girl, and he never named her. And I just thought, I don't know, what a great name for like a superhero or something, Midwestern Girl.
Yeah.
And so I started writing these little vignettes where she sort of was sentient, if you will. And over the course of the story, she kind of takes over the narrative for herself.
Yeah, I love the way it's such a brilliant story. And I love the way she starts, yeah, taking control of the narrative, as you said, that is very effective. So is it fair to say that this story is a critique of male authors who create underdeveloped female characters?
Yeah, I think that's fair. For me, it was just about sort of writing the characters that maybe I wish that I had read more of growing up, or the characters perhaps that I was still reading in books that I wanted to see more of.
Mm-hmm. A lot of your stories in this collection feature historical women, like the book's title character, Cassandra, who was Apollo's Trojan priestess in Greek mythology. You also have a woman named Gwen, who was the first woman hanged for witchcraft in Wales. Why did you want to write about real women from the past?
Well, I've always loved history. In my free time, I'm always listening to like history podcasts and all of those things. And I find it so exciting to learn about women from the past who sort of don't fit the mold of historical women that I learned kind of in school. I feel like when I was in school, women, you know, were like sewing flags, or maybe they were married to a more famous and interesting man. But they were pretty rarely, I mean, I guess a little bit like the Midwestern girl character, they were pretty rarely front and center. And so when I would learn their stories now, like, you know, Boudica and the witch and all of these women, I just thought, how amazing, how cool to take a risk and have the chance to bring their voices to readers who might then, you know, if I'm lucky, look them up online and learn a little bit something about how radical women really have always been.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you have a favorite historical woman story in the book?
Oh, gosh, that's very hard to choose. Probably the first woman hanged for witchcraft in Wales. That story has a very soft place in my heart because it does what I enjoy doing with history, which is to say, in that story, I get to change history. Unsurprisingly, the first woman hanged for witchcraft in Wales died, as you would. But, you know, one of the things I always found so weird about witch trials was like, if you were a witch, how were a bunch of like lame villagers in the 1500s going to kill you? You would just use your magic. So I wanted to write a story where, you know, the villagers had actually got their hands on a witch. And so, of course, when they go to hang her, she can free herself. And that felt like a wonderful tribute to a very, very long ago Gwen who was not that lucky.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very well said. You've said that your writing has become angrier as it has become more honest. Can you talk about how this increasing anger and honesty informs the characters and stories in your book?
Yeah, I think a lot of people today are angry. I feel like that's an emotion that is really widespread as it is. And as a woman, you know, you're not really supposed to be angry. The label angry feminist is a very quick way to have your point of view discounted. But I just felt dishonest writing about the experience of women without writing about the ways in which, yes, of course, we're angry. So for example, a story in the collection, A Few Normal Things That Happen a Lot, is about these sort of daily indignities that women go through. And I think, I mean, every single one in that story is something that has happened to me personally. So being harassed at a bus stop, being stalked around a grocery store, being groped, those are all things that have happened to me. And so the kind of catharsis of the story is that, you know, when that happens to these women, they use their superpowers to kick some ass. The anger in the story is very, very real, even if the sort of imaginative world that I create to process that anger is more fabulous.
Mm-hmm. I love that story. It's one of my favorites, especially as you were saying about how you escalated it and take it to this kind of super heroic, surreal level.
A woman walks down the street and a man tells her to smile. When she smiles, she reveals a mouthful of fangs. She bites off the man's hand, cracks the bones, and spits them out, and accidentally swallows his wedding ring, which gives her indigestion. A woman waits for the bus, and a man stands too close to her. He puts his hand on her ass with no idea that she is the first successful subject of a top-secret science experiment. She turns and points her laser eyes at him and transforms him into bus fare, $2.75 in cool coins.
Did you know from the get-go, like as before you started writing the story, that it was going to escalate this way and go into this kind of surreal direction?
Well, I knew it was going to be surreal. So the story sort of started as more of just a cathartic writing exercise. It was the day of the Brett Kavanaugh hearings, and I was very angry. And so I just started writing these little paragraphs that were more for me than anything else, just wanting to kind of relive those memories, but let them be ones in which I won. But as I kept working on the story and those characters started to reappear, I started to really think, like, what does it mean for these women to have to resort to violence? And how does that hurt them? Because I think there's a real kind of anger and joy and catharsis to the story, but I hope there's also a pretty profound sadness to the story, which is that these women, by the end, you know, the fangs in their mouth make their gums bleed, and the ladies who came up with the radioactive cockroaches are covered in scars from all the different times they've tried and failed to kind of defend themselves from men, essentially.
You mentioned that part of the inspiration for the story is that the misbehavior, the kind of misbehaviors you suffered at the hands of men. So I'm wondering, as you wrote the story, was it difficult? I imagine it was kind of like, was it difficult? Did you have flashbacks to that? Or were you kind of focused on, you know, the empowering nature of kind of the women's revenge, for lack of a better term?
Well, I think the strange thing is that because those things are not uncommon for me and for most women, I don't really experience them as flashbacks. I think that you compartmentalize them as being okay. You're okay. It was never that bad. It's okay. And that way the memories of it don't hurt you to a certain extent. So no, it didn't kind of trigger me, if we want to put it that way. And it's been funny talking about that story with other women because, one, those experiences are really universal, and two, mostly we all laugh about them. It's so clear that that laughter is kind of our coping mechanism, and that in the book itself, clearly I as a writer use laughter and humor as a coping mechanism.
I love the way you experiment with story form and structure in stories like Jerry's Crab Shack, One Star, which is written as a Yelp review. And you also give us some great home repair advice in How to Retile Your Bathroom in 6 Easy Steps. What inspired these two stories?
Well, the How to Retile Your Bathroom story was kind of serendipity, just in that I knew I wanted to write a story about this woman who was about to get divorced. She's kind of just been broken up with by her husband. And I really enjoy writing stories where characters' emotions get to come out in like a physical action. And I think that you can see that throughout the book. I mean, the women are, they're fighting with swords, or they're prostitutes, or they're whatever it is. I think it's a very physical book. And so I wanted this woman to just take out her anger about this by just retiling her bathroom and having it go terribly wrong. I do not know anything about retiling a bathroom. I have never retiled anything in my whole life. And so, of course, I did just what this woman would do. And I went to the WikiHow article on how to retile your bathroom in 6 easy steps. And once I was reading that article, I thought, this would be a great form for the story. It'll give a physical step-by-step frame to the story while letting a lot of tangents take place during the story. Because it's an incredibly interior story. Not a lot happens, quote-unquote, even as it's so physical. So that just really came from my own ignorance of bathroom retiling. Jerry's Crab Shack, One Star, I think came very much out of my fascination with reviews and how amazingly personal some people's reviews are online. I mean, I love like when you're just trying to figure out like, will this restaurant be okay? And suddenly you're reading like the saga of someone's life, and like you know their children's names, and they're like, you know, this was just like the Christmas Eve when this happened, and that's why I'll never go to Bob's Burger Palace again. And you're like, so I love those places on the internet that are so public and yet so private and so personal. And I really kind of wanted to see if I could make something out of that form. And that's why I started playing with the Yelp review and how I met Greg, who I have such a soft spot for.
Yeah, because talk a bit about that without spoiling the story. If you can talk about just like what he goes through as he's writing the review.
Yeah, well, so Greg, you can see at the beginning of the story that Greg has become a Yelp member at about 10 p.m. and the review's posted at 2 a.m. And he just moved to Baltimore and he tries to take his wife out for this nice dinner. Pretty much everything goes wrong from the start. He hasn't really researched the restaurant appropriately. It's not what he expects it to be. And the review kind of begins to get off track, if you will, as it kind of becomes, rather than a review of Jerry's Crab Shack, it becomes kind of a review of his wife, himself, and his marriage. He kind of resists it. He's like, I would never review my wife. But if I were going to review my wife, here are a few things I would say. And so you could just kind of feel as his emotions kind of carry him away.
Since we're based here in America's Dairyland, I have to ask you about three Wisconsin references you make: the Milwaukee Brewers, the Wisconsin Dells, and Beloit. Is there any particular significance to these references?
Well, I went to undergrad at Carleton College in Minnesota. And so even though I'm a native San Diegan, I have spent a decent amount of time in Minnesota and in Wisconsin. And I have a very, very vivid memory of being, I think, 16, and my family and I were driving across Wisconsin, and we just stumbled across the Wisconsin Dells. We had never heard of them. We did not know what they were. And suddenly we were in like a mini golf mecca that just is dear to my heart. So I love the Midwest, and I enjoy peppering it into my writing.
Gwen Kirby, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Gwen Kirby is the author of the short story collection, Blank Cassandra Saw. Fill in the blank with a word for something you don't want to step in. Well done. Find out more at WPR.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Lewis Black, Michael Schur, and Gwen Kirby. Beta is available to follow on Apple Podcasts or wherever you catch your favorite pods. Just search for Wisconsin Public Radio and Beta. And you can keep up with us during the week online at WPR.org/beta or on Twitter at WPRBeta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic.
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
You guys don't have any lame mandatory office hangouts, right?
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
I mean, what do you get somebody who wants to eat a unicorn?
And thanks to you, our alphas. More Beta comes your way next week. Until then, I'm Doug Gordon.
Yo, you should listen to me. I came up with hundreds of plans in my life, and only one of them got me killed.